Okay.
Today is Thursday, June 18, 2020. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. Good, thanks.
Great. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you very much. At the end of the last history discussion, you had mentioned you became friends with a climber, one of the cutting-edge climbers of Yosemite at the time, a guy named Jim Bridwell, B-R-I-D-W-E-L-L. Can you talk a little bit about the climber's camp, Camp 4, and the cutting-edge climbing that Bridwell and others were doing, and how did the park keep up with these people? How did the park work on its rescue skills to help these people when they got in trouble?
Okay. So in late 68, I believe, Pete Thompson, who was the Sista Valley District Ranger, which is a position I had for a long time, but was simultaneously the park's overall search and rescue officer, and of course it wasn't too long and that turned into a full-time position, but initially he was in a different job. So at that time, you know, the big walls were being challenged, lots of first ascents on El Cap and Half Dome, and you know, climbing was really becoming coming into its own. And Yosemite is one of the best places in the world to rock climb, maybe perhaps almost the best. So, you know, the park rangers had their hands full with the counterculture and all the other aspects of being a ranger. And most of the rangers did not have any real interest and or showed any real ability to do much climbing. Everybody knew how to rappel and some of the real basics, but beyond that, we really didn't, and I say we collectively, really didn't know, you know, how to keep up with these guys. So over time, on some of the big missions, which there weren't that many in the late 60s, early 70s, but on the big wall rescues, we had to rely on climbers from Camp 4 to go out and rescue their own. There was put into place a way to pay them for some of what they were doing. Initially, you know, some of them would just volunteer, and that because the mechanics for how to reimburse and organize what have you really hadn't fallen into place yet. So Camp 4 was the climber's camp. It was also called Sunnyside. And the story I've always heard is just that, one, you know, in the wintertime, because it was you could camp there all year round. In fact, it was, I think, for quite a few years, the only campground in the valley that was open in the winter. There just wasn't much camping going on in the winter in Yosemite. And Yosemite, as attractive as it is and as popular as it is these days, it was not that popular back in the earlier, the 40s, 50s, even into the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's called Sunnyside because that would get the first sun of the winter morning. Now, whether that's just a nice story or there's really truth to that, I'm not 100% sure. So, but the climbers would camp there, and in the wintertime, or in the off-season, the shoulder seasons, as well as the winter, the Park Service wasn't really too hot about enforcing any kind of camping limits. In the summertime, it was 14 days, and even that was abused quite a bit. But in the off-season, the shoulder months and the winter, as I said, not many people... You know, the Park Service did not enforce any kind of camping limit. So it was a popular place, and people, the younger generation particularly, and the climbers in specific, would you know, they spend a whole winter up there. It would take them very little to survive and to make ends meet when you're camping out of your car or out of a tent and not eating, you know, fancy anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was an attractive place, and it became a destination spot for climbers from around the world because, you know, they wanted to get in on the El Cap and the Half Dome and the first ascent kinds of climbs. 1958, Wayne Mary and Royal Robbins and, I think it was a group of five, Bill Dolt, you know, were the first to climb El Cap, and Wayne was a student at San Diego State, ended up becoming a park ranger in Yosemite, was one of the few rangers in the park when I was there that was interested in climbing. So some of the real colorful people, one in particular was a guy by the name of Jim Bridwell, who was probably, I think you could make an argument for the best athletic rock climber in the world. He was setting all kinds of standards and pushing the envelope in any number of ways, and he had lots of peers that were in that same genre or same category, I guess. But Jim was the top of the heap, if you will, and he, good-looking guy, charismatic, long hair, impeccably muscled and chiseled, would make great commercials, actually. In fact, he ended up making commercials for at least Camel cigarettes, which he ends up dying of from lung cancer.
Oh, my.
But, you know, and again, this is the day when there's lots of marijuana, lots of LSD, you know, a fair amount of drugs taking place in the park. And, you know, the climbers, not that they were any much worse than a lot of the other people there, but they were tending to abuse some of these drugs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, and I'll come back to Bridwell in a second, but over time, we would, I mean, me personally, as well as my co-workers, would have to deal with some climber halfway up El Cap who was spacing out on LSD.
Wow.
And would be on these little ledges, you know, little places where they'd bivouac for the night, and they'd drop acid, and they would, you know, we would end up using the public announcing system, the PA system in the patrol cars, and then we had a telescope, was a Questar, Q-U-E-S-T-A-R, Questar, which I think is actually the make, but it was something like a 120 power telescope, and you could read the label on somebody's underwear. So we would play 20 questions and talk, and you know, with these guys up on the walls, not only those that were dropping acid, but people who'd been hurt as well. So it was one of these things, you know, raise your right hand if you need help kinds of questions.
Okay.
So we did a lot of that, and Bridwell was on both the ends of the spectrum. There were times on when he would be on the wall, intoxicated or under the influence of something, and I'm not suggesting he was getting ready to jump off or anything, but he was affected. But he was also the guy that we went to in order to help us out. One of them, and of course there were a number of them, but he was one of the key players that we could get hold of and count on because of his abilities on the rock. And he was pretty good about taking instructions and staying within certain parameters that we would set for how these rescues ought to be conducted. Although ultimately, in I think 1977, for a short period of time, I fired him off of the rescue site. But we had a group of roughly 12 or 15 of these climbers that were living in Camp 4. And, in the summertime, we would enforce camping limits, which I think was 14 days, if I'm not mistaken. But if you were in the rescue site, sort of with a capital R and a capital S, then you could camp there free. So there was some desire by these people, these young climbers, to get into that rescue site because they could climb. And the only commitment on their part was that when they were around, they would be available for us to use on a rescue.
Wow.
And occasionally a search, but mostly just rescues.
I mean, that sounds like a really reasonable way to approach it. You've got a bunch of very talented people that can help in rescues, and you give them a place to stay.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And, it was you scratch my back and I'll scratch your back.
Did Pete Thompson come up with that idea, or did you, or was that
No, who came up with that? It was long before me, several years before I got there.
Okay.
Now, Pete and Wayne Mary, who now at this point had moved from Yosemite and to Denali, and was the chief ranger, and he's like one of the few rangers at Mount McKinley in those days. It was Mount McKinley National Park.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But so he was up there as a mountaineer, and he got offered a job, even though he'd been with the government, federal government, for now 6 or 7 years, maybe. He quit. They offered him to run the Yosemite Mountaineering School, YMS, in Yosemite Valley.
Hmm.
So they started up a climbing instruction program there. And the Curry Company, which was the main concessionaire at the time, had for years been running a cross-country ski and downhill ski schools. So it was sort of a natural jump to include rock climbing, and Wayne ended up overseeing that part of the operation, and he was asked to go down there by maybe like the vice president of the Yosemite Park and Curry Company. So he was our go-between, and he spoke both Park Service and climbing, and he was well-respected by both sides, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And terribly nice guy, terribly talented, although he's just recently deceased about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to write a justification nomination thing, because he lived in Canada, and I don't know if he was actually a Canadian citizen, but he lived in Canada for years and years and years. And I actually wrote a fairly glowing nomination for some sort of prestigious Canadian government recognition.
Hmm. Nice.
But maybe a little lower level, but the Medal of Freedom that the United States gives.
Okay.
So, as I say, he was well-respected by both the climbers and the Park Service. And he and Pete would go to him and say, well, we've got somebody trapped on this particular spot. We really need some help, he would have several instructors that were climbing instructors, and they would end up being part of a larger team, but generally they would be the ones that might be the supervisors of climbers. And Jim Bridwell was part of that group as well. And so Pete would go to Wayne. Wayne would say, okay, let's, we'll get this guy and this guy and this guy and this person. And that's who we would end up putting on the helicopter or equipping with, gear although a lot of them used their own gear, of course, as well. But we ended up having, you know, a lot of equipment in our rescue cache, which over time, well, actually, it's not over time, in a very short time, was probably the largest, what am I saying, mountain rescue, search and rescue cache in the country, not only just the park, but in the country. And that came about as a result of an incident you probably want to hear about here in a few minutes. But that's how the relationship was for years, for several years, including when I was there at the very beginning in 1971, summer of 71. And, you know, I was at a spot where I could barely tell you where El Cap was or Half Dome and try to keep them separate. So it wasn't like I was any great whiz-bang. But I did have some climbing experience and a fair amount of outdoor experience at this point. So it was a subject that I really enjoyed and wanted to get involved with. And that's what made working in particularly Yosemite Valley so much fun, is that, you know, on any given day, you could be on a rescue, you could be making a felony arrest, you could be on a structural fire, you could be, you know, stabilizing somebody with a broken back. And you know, of course, that would be an exceptional day, you know, one day's period, but that sort of thing did happen with so much frequency. That's what made it so much fun.
Hmm. Okay.
So Jim Bridwell, as I say, was the king of the heap. And he had a whole cadre of camp followers, as, you know, he probably broke any number of women's hearts along the way. And most of them were these, you know, I don't know how underage they were, but let's say 17 and 18 and 19-year-olds that were up there sort of, you know, the hippie young ladies. So, you know, sort of the free love period of time, lots of, you know, dope and stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim, we would use quite often, and he would be often the, you know, the focus of incidents. So one big rescue that took place, it's probably one of the earliest big wall rescues in Yosemite's history was, hold on just a second. I'll get a book real quick.
Okay.
I think it's going to be, it's like 1972. In fact, well, no, that's not it. Okay, so this particular incident took place on September 22, 1972, but the story has to start in August, if I'm not mistaken, when a 17-year-old boy who had been working on a trail crew up towards Merced Lake, which is in the park, when he got stung by a bee and had to be airlifted out because he was going into anaphylactic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
When they found out that he was only 17, and I don't know the story of how he got to be employed to begin with, but he was not 18. So they got him to the hospital. They flew him out of Merced Lake to the hospital or to the clinic there in the valley. And they found out he was 17 while he was fired. And to try to get back into the saving graces of the federal government and the National Park Service, he ends up coming up with this plan to set the Park Service's barn on fire, which was housing, I don't know, roughly 20 horses and mules, including the matched Morgan patrol horses, which were up like eight or 10 of them, because Yosemite had a pretty good horse patrol.
Okay.
So he sets his barn on fire at night, and he thinks that he's going to by going in and saving these animals, he will be congratulated and thanked and get back into the Park Service as an employee. Well, things backfire, no pun intended, and he ends up killing, I think, roughly, say, 16 animals.
Jeez.
And the only real injury to a human was that he personally got kicked by one of these animals, and I took him to the hospital, to the clinic, although at the time we did not know who he was. We just thought he was one of the many people responding to this incident trying to help out.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the same time, in addition to this barn burning down and several CCC-era buildings and a couple of buildings from the 1890s that were there, quite a great big footprint was burned to the ground.
Wow, so he's a pyromaniac and he's torching a whole bunch of buildings?
No, it just the one building with the horses.
Okay, just that one, but
the
that
barn, but it spread.
That one, oh, it did. Hey.
Yeah. Well, things were, they would add rooms on to different buildings, and there was a pretty good fire continuation. You could go from one building to the next. And,
oh, dear.
And a lot of these were very old buildings that had been dried out for years and years and
sure,
years.
Sure, sure.
But including a facility that had the rescue cache in it. And so all of a sudden the park, at least the valley, had almost nothing.
Wow.
No ropes, no beaners, no pitons, no minimal kinds of water rescue, that sort of thing. So Pete was, as I say, this is in 72, Pete was at this point the search and rescue officer. So he goes to different outlets. I have to think about this. The name sort of slipped me right at the moment, but some of the more prestigious mountaineering and outdoor places in Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
Well, North Face would be one. Went to them and called down south to Los Angeles, and he's trying to get as many ropes and things as he could, because we had a guy on this September 22, about 1,800 feet down from the top of El Cap, who had fallen, and he had broken his right leg significantly. And we didn't have any long ropes at that time. Everything that, that could be scrounged from outside the other the other districts, were 150 foot lengths kinds of stuff. Nothing that would really be satisfactory for something this huge, this high, this long. So he goes out, and we end up getting, within a period of about 12 hours, at least two ropes each was 4,400 feet long each.
Wow.
And about six or eight, perhaps even more, 1,200 footers, some 600 feet ropes. And the real long ropes were actually yacht, YACHT, boating ropes, half-inch gold lawn, GOLDLON, not gold line, but gold lawn.
What's the difference?
Well, there's just the way they're constructed.
Okay.
Gold line is a twist.
Yep.
Gold lawn has a sheath on it, and that's the way climbing ropes are done today.
So this is Perlon. Yeah.
This is a totally different.
Okay.
I mean, it's a synthetic, of course, but and it has a lot of stretch to it, but it's a totally different kind of a rope, and it's not intended for any kind of climbing. But
okay.
Yet, if something's half an inch thick and it's made of nylon, even though it's not intended for climbing, it's going to probably work once anyway.
Yes.
Well, as it turns out, over years and years, and I was there, part of the time I was a search and rescue officer, but I was riding the rescue cache almost every day, practically, it seems. you know, we had these 4,400-foot long ropes, which we never ended up using.
Oh my gosh!
So they were 330 pounds. We know that.
Oh my gosh!
But and we had them, you know, we had them weighed, and we had them up so that we could sling them underneath a helicopter if we needed to.
Right.
So, you know, we had that, but we ended up never having to use them. Although we did have some long drops, and we used the 1,200-footers all the time. Well, the ropes weren't designed for mountain rescue, and it didn't take long to recognize that because the sheath that would protect the inner core
right.
would separate real quickly. Although I don't have any personal photos of them anymore, I've seen photos where there'd be these 10 and 15-foot long stretches where the sheath had been pulled back.
Wow.
Now, that really didn't substantially affect the strength and from a practical standpoint, but it's a little unnerving if you're hanging up a rope 600 feet up, you know.
Yep.
So.
Hey, Butch.
Yes.
Can we back up for a minute to the guy that set that barn on fire?
Yeah.
How did you figure out that he did it?
Well, of course, I didn't figure it out, but I think that Lee Shackleton, who was the law enforcement specialist, somehow, well, I guess I don't have a great answer for you, which is sort of surprising now that I think about it. I actually should know this, but I don't exactly how he was found out. I don't know.
Okay.
Actually, right. I do know that, you know, he was found out. They brought in the fire marshal. They brought in some arson investigators. Because, you know, it was a significant fire.
Yeah.
I've always written that in a city setting, it would have been at least a 2-alarm fire, maybe even a 3-alarm fire.
Wow. Okay.
And, of course, we were attacking it, and I say we. I wasn't even part of the fire response. My wife was the dispatcher when this was taking place, and I was home asleep and didn't even know the fire was going on until I heard people running down outside my window, running down the street, which is only a long block away from where this fire was taking place.
Okay.
So, but I did end up responding, and, you know, just because I was, you know, one of the helpers there, I put this guy, ended up getting this guy to the clinic. And I think somewhere I might even have his name, but
okay.
Well, he wasn't high on my radar screen.
Eventually he was discovered, but
yeah.
that burned up the cache.
Yeah,
so now you've got this climber. He's got a broken leg. He's 1,000 feet. What, 1,800 feet down from the top? Well, how far is that up from the bottom?
Well, it's about 1,800 feet from the bottom. It's about 1,200 feet from the top. It's the other way around. And I was mistaken when I said that. So he's roughly 1,200 feet from the top. It's about a 3,000-foot face at that spot. And he's roughly 1,800 feet.
Okay.
So now this fire and the incident are taking place roughly maybe 3 or 4 weeks in between the two events.
Okay.
And in the meantime, you know, Pete is moving to get equipment brought in and what have you. But when this guy got himself hurt, halfway down El Cap, that really expedited the need. And, you know, the California Highway Patrol provided assistance. They put equipment in their cars and drove them to the helicopters. The Marine Corps base there in El Toro flew two ships up, two big Jolly Green Giants with equipment up for us.
So I'm going to back up for a minute here. When I think of these cliffs like El Capitan or Half Dome, and I think of a helicopter, I don't put the two together very well because the helicopter rotor blades are going to keep that ship away from the cliff face by a good enough distance, and that cliff is kind of straight up and down. So
yeah.
It seems as though your only option is to climb up from the bottom, which is going to take time, or rope down from the top with a very long rope, and hope you're at the right location or sort of pendulum your way over to somebody if you can get over there. All that sounds complicated and terrifying.
Well, some of your supposition's not quite correct.
Okay.
There are places on El Cap where you can actually get in close enough with a helicopter, particularly a smaller helicopter.
Okay.
And today, you know, 2020, beginning in 2015 or even earlier, I guess, Yosemite has taken the lead and has pioneered, perfected some helicopter maneuvering and use of rescuers. Most of them are the park rangers. Rescuers who are actually placed on the face of El Cap by using a helicopter.
Okay.
So having said that, in 1972 and with two exceptions while I was there, the 10 years I was there, we always went to the top, at least we never made a helicopter to the wall kind of an exchange except twice while I was there.
And so I'm assuming then that there must be some sort of like a nose that comes out away from the wall far enough and is flat enough that you can actually get a skid on and get somebody off onto the nose? How does this work?
No.
Or does the wall actually lay back enough?
Well, what are you talking about? Are you talking about back then or now?
Both.
Back then, we didn't do any of that.
Okay.
No, we would go to the top, and as I said, there were two exceptions to that, and one exception was the one that I was involved with, one of the two, but the only one that I was personally involved with that I actually remembered was, you know, there are pedestals up there where there are ledges that stick out 20 or 30 feet.
Uh-huh.
So on one occasion, we ended up taking a climbing rope with a bag full of equipment, a backpack or a big knapsack, or I guess it's probably actually a duffel bag, with equipment in it, a 600-foot rope and some water and a radio and miscellaneous stuff, because two guys had gotten themselves trapped on this big ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to pendulum the equipment into them.
Okay.
So we could do that, and the Navy was the one that did that. I was actually the SAR officer at this point, and I said, well, you know, rather than spending all day going down from the top, how about if we try something new? And they said, yeah, we'll try it, which was this pendulum.
Right.
Which worked. And as it turns out, there had actually been one before this time. And I wasn't, I was out of the park and I wasn't familiar with it. But in years since, I've since learned about that. So, but those are the only two that we went to the wall. Every other time we'd go to the top.
Okay.
And, you know, in this case, the Jolly Green Giants were taking the equipment up there and dropping them off with manpower. And so with this, I'm trying to remember this guy's name, Neil Olsen, Olsen was his name. And he, as I said, broke a leg about 1,200 feet from the top. Rescue team of about 20, mostly climbers, were taken to the top, and the whole thing was orchestrated by the lead instructor for the mountaineering school, Lloyd Price. That's just one Lloyd Price, and Pete Thompson. So they end up dropping, or lowering rather, Jim Bridwell down to, well, let me backtrack for just a second. So this guy is on a ledge, and he's got a climbing partner, I think maybe even two climbing partners, but at least one. So they put five or six climbers onto that ledge. They lower them down to this about 1,200 feet to this big ledge. So now you've got six or eight people on this ledge, including Jim Bridwell. And then they end up putting this guy in a stretcher and then lowering him and Bridwell as the attendant down 1,800 feet. And at the time, it was the longest single stage rope lowering in mountaineering history.
Wow.
So, but the whole thing took over 2 days to
wow.
orchestrate and then to, you know, engineer and then get this guy down. So Bridwell, and there's these, you know, famous photos of Jim, you know, no helmet, being lowered with this guy in the stretcher. And the guy in the stretcher is keying the microphone for Jim as he's being lowered. And there's, you know, there must be 500 people laying in the meadow below watching this whole thing.
Wow.
I was the assistant on this, but, you know, assistant to Pete, which meant that mostly I was just a gopher because I didn't, you know, I could hardly spell all cap, let alone really do much with it. But they ended up lowering Jim all the way down. And then, you know, some of the climbers that were all actually on the wall itself, not on top, but on the wall itself, you know, some of them wanted to come off that night. And so the park electricians built a light bank that illuminated the entire face of El Cap.
Wow.
And so these guys were able to rappel down, all the way down. And there's a, you know, there are bolts in various places where there is a rappel system. I mean, you can go from one to the next, to the next,
mm-hmm.
to the next,
mm-hmm.
and get down. So they all come down, everybody's safe and sound, nobody gets hurt. But, you know, Jim is touted, and that as, you know, recognized, not touted, but recognized for what he has done. But the whole team was recognized, you know, mostly these 20 climbers were recognized for this incident, which, in mountaineering history, not just Park Service, but in mountaineering history around the world, this is really quite a precedent setting.
Nice.
Precedenting setting.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, so Jim was in the middle of all that. And, but as I like to always say, you know, every one of these incidents is a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Jim might have got the play, but the truth is that there are a lot of other people helping him out as well. So.
Yeah, sure.
So, okay, so you want to talk about, well, I guess I don't know much about the guy that started the fire. We've already gone through that.
Yep, yep. No, this is very helpful. I think it really brings home a ecclesial cooperative effort between people with skills and the agency for a good benefit of all, it seems like.
Well, and these guys lived in Camp 4, and that's what they, you know, they didn't live so much for the rescues, but they lived for this kind of exposure, this kind of climbing, and this kind of, you know, pushing the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of the rangers didn't have that, well, none of the park rangers had that skill level, for sure.
Right.
One, they didn't have the time to develop it. There were just too many other things going on, because the climbers in Camp 4, you know, they'd spend 3, 4, 5, 6 months every year doing nothing but climbing.
Mm. Right, right. Day in, so, day out.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. And they knew where the routes were on the faces and
or they were putting them up.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So they knew the wall really well.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, Jim would have been right at the top of that.
Okay.
Scenario.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about at this time period in the mid-70s was hang gliding off of a place called Glacier Point. Is that right?
Glacier Point. Right.
Do you have any thoughts or remembrances about that?
Well, let me give you one more real short story on Bridwell.
Okay, please.
I told you I'd fired him.
Yeah, why did you do that?
I think it was 1977. We had three. I think I mentioned the helicopter crash maybe yesterday or the day.
You did.
Before.
You did. The Navy.
Yeah, the Navy.
Huey. Yeah.
So the very next day, We had three guys killed in three separate incidents, three separate days, back to back to back. And the first two I didn't go out on, and the helicopter was the second day. But the third day, the training that was coordinating, which is on, you know, drugs and stuff. And of course, I wasn't teaching. I was just facilitating it.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a guy who was not really a climber, but he was trying to learn to climb, and he didn't even have climbing shoes on. He had these big Vibram-soled hiking boots, and he was climbing in an area called the Penny Nickel Arete, Penny-Nickel Arete, A-R-E-T-E, which was one pitch long, roughly 100 feet high. It was up a side canyon, so you just couldn't walk to it. You had to scramble up through the rocks and the boulders and stuff to get to it.
Hmm.
And he and his girlfriend were climbing up there, and he was doing something that he was not prepared to climb in, and he didn't really have the right shoes, for, at least. And he was at a doing a like an upper mid-level climb when he should have been just doing a basic
right.
elementary climb.
Huh.
So he ends up falling and killing himself. And so I take a recovery team to go get him, and we're definitely sure he's dead. I mean, his climbing partner said there's absolutely no question this guy is dead, you know. So I've got Bridwell with me, and I've got a group of maybe six, eight, nine other people as well, several rangers as well as climbers. Because at this point, all we're looking for is manpower just to carry the stretcher down
mm-hmm.
through the rocks and eventually to the road in the valley. So Jim and I are up there, and the equipment is still tied to the top of this cliff. And I have to go back and look at the report exactly, you know, how this all happened. But there was a rope still hooked to the top. And so Jim, rather than climbing with protection, meaning that in some way he was going to protect himself going up, which he could easily have done, he ends up free climbing this without any protection. It's a 5-7
wow.
route. Today they do 5-15s,
right?
Although that's the exception, but they still do that, you know. So they've really graduated considerably.
Oh yeah.
But so he scrambles up this 5-7, and before I know, hardly before I look around, he's already on top. I mean, he was just that good.
Hmm.
And he retrieves the equipment and rappels off. And there's a way you can just, you know, you pull the rope back behind you, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we end up taking this guy down, this body out. And when we get to the rescue cache, I tell Jim, I said, you know, there was absolutely no reason why you did that. You did not need to be doing this free. There was no hurry. There was no emergency. This is a team effort kind of a thing. And you do not need to be risking your neck, even though you're very capable. You don't need to be risking your neck and then putting the rescue team in jeopardy.
Right.
So I said, you're no longer in the rescue site, right?
Okay.
So I fired him. I mean, I had to, you know, you're no longer there. Well, of course, you know, everybody knows everybody, and to some degree, you're good acquaintances or even friends with some of these people. And it's kind of hard to be too harsh, but... And I know that Jim and his, you know, since he had so many friends, you know, and probably several girlfriends, all he had to do was say, okay, I mean, you know, I understand, and then, you know, go hide out with somebody else in somebody else's tent.
Right.
Which I'm sure is what he did. Well, a couple of weeks later, and I don't recall the incident, but I had to go back to Jim because we had some big mission on, you know, El Cap or Half Dome or someplace where we needed his expertise. So I basically, you know, with hat in hand, you will, you know, all is forgiven, Jim. You know, we need your help again. So you know, I, as I say, I fired him. One time I cited him in the court, and that's because I was willing to take these kinds of stances, I guess.
Now you rehired him.
Well, I did rehire him, although I reinstated him more, rehired him, because we didn't pay anybody until we had to use him anyway.
Right.
But reinstated him to the site, so now, again, that he was technically legal to camp and, you know, whatever. So there is some prestige, although today they've got, you know, yellow T-shirts that say, I think they say YOSAR, Yosemite Search and Rescue, YOSAR, which actually I'm on the board for the Friends of YOSAR now.
Cool.
So, but in those days there was no real recognition other than word of mouth that the climbers knew who was what.
Right.
You know, who was, what kind of a hierarchy there was.
It must have been prestigious for those guys.
Well, it was.
In their own world.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And it was. So, what was your question now? We were talking, that I told you, hold on just a second.
Well, we were asking about hang gliding, but, yeah, no, this is interesting about Bridwell. And did he just look at it as if nothing had happened and said, yeah, how can I help? Let's get going.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, he might not have even paid much attention. I'm pretty sure we didn't use him in between time, but whether he took it as seriously as I intended it to be, I'll never know. But, and how the interaction was when, you know, I'm metaphorically, I guess is the right term, or is that right? Where I'm asking, you know, standing there asking him to come back, you know, all is forgiven. You know, how he reacted, I frankly don't remember that.
Okay.
And I, you know, it's probably, you know, we were probably in such a emergency state and quasi panic that.
Right, right. You know, did he leave the valley before you? Or was he still in the valley when you left?
Well, he was still around. I mean, I don't know that he's necessarily living in the valley the whole time, but, you know, because he would go out. He was a carpenter by, I think, trade, really. He ended up, along with a couple of other climbers in the park, ended up becoming not stuntmen, but, you know, they would help fix, not scaffolding, but they would help on movie sets and on TV shows.
Rigging.
Rigging, there you go, that's the right term. You know, they would facilitate those kinds of things.
Okay.
There was one show, I think it might have been That's Incredible, that, you know, where they had people in the river, and so these guys would be, you know, working on the cliffs nearby and that sort of thing. So he did some of that as well. But, you know, when I moved on to the Grand Canyon, he was still around the park, but not necessarily 24/7.
Okay.
So hang gliding, you know, I've got this all written down. I guess I should have looked this up too, I suppose. But about 1970 or so, you know, which again is the, you know, the time of the riot, and there's all kinds of hippies, and there's all kinds of law enforcement problems, and climbing is just starting to mushroom, and the park is just overwhelmed by business and new experiences for the rangers, for sure. So the hang gliding community came to the park management and said, you know, how about, can we do this? So the park said, here's a trial. We'll let you do 12 each day. You guys will have to self-police. The only people that can go off are, there's a certain high level in hang gliding circles, a certain kind of a rating, you know, like, you know, you're the best in that, you know, you've done X number of hang glides and stuff.
Right. I think at that time it went from hang one to hang five or something like that.
Well, I think then if hang five was the highest or the best, I think that our requirement was that only those people who had hang five credentials could jump, and they were limited to 12 a day, and they had to do it before, say, 7 in the morning so that there wasn't too much of a visual impact. And they had to land in the El Cap Meadow as opposed to right below the Glacier Point. And Glacier Point you can drive to in the summertime, and it's got enough vertical cliffs, and there's a little place where you could just run down this sloping rock and then launch yourself. So they started doing this, and they are actually pretty good. I mean, they self-policed, and over the years, they still do this. Over the years, there have only been one or two serious accidents. I don't think anybody's been killed even in 50 years, roughly. So, I'm trying to remember. I can actually visualize the first. We had a seasonal ranger who we hired because he had hang gliding experience. He could talk the language and knew who was who and could tell when somebody was pulling our chain in terms of their credentials and stuff.
Right. I think that's right. I seem to remember there was a Park Service employee that would kind of check people out. And,
well, so are you a hang glider?
Well, we'll talk later, but yeah, I'm just kind of putting this together after a long, long time.
Hmm. Yeah.
But it seemed like it worked fairly well.
Well, it did. And it was, and for a number of years, I mean, quite a few years, I mean, longer than I was there, at least 10 or 12 years, maybe longer, you know, they actually had a ranger who was responsible for the hang gliding program. I mean, that's not all he did because, you know, it was over by, you know.
Right, 7 in the morning, you're done.
It's over with. So, and there wasn't, you know, there was no equipment to clean up or anything. So, you know, he still had to be, you know, a regular protection ranger. So we used that person on rescues and road patrol and whatever, too. Mm-hmm. So he just didn't, you know, sit around waiting for the next hang glider to jump.
Right.
But it was limited to 12 a day, and there might have been some other restrictions that I can't recall, but basically, you know, that's all they had to do. And ultimately, of course, the parachutists, the skydivers, got in on that picture too and sort of screwed themselves over, which, you know, I can come back to. But the hang gliding itself was all from the same spot. Now, that doesn't mean that occasionally somebody didn't try to do something from some other spot.
But, I see.
They didn't really have to because they were legal, you know, by going off Glacier Point. So, I guess, so do you have any questions about hang gliding?
No, I think that about covers it. Then what happened with the jumpers and the parachuters?
Well, you know, and I got to remember, I mean, I have 111 jumps myself, so it wasn't that I wasn't empathetic to skydivers. But, hold on just a second. Okay, so Linda's going to the bank. I just had to talk to her a second.
Hmm.
Sorry about that. So I spoke, you know, I spoke skydiving and climbing and parachuting pretty good.
Okay.
Actually. And so the first jump in Yosemite was, I think, in 1965. Actually, no, 1966, I think.
And this was just like running off the cliff with a chute, and then you just simply deploy it, and you're on your way.
Actually, it was 1965, and two guys went off of El Cap, and they both ended up hurting themselves. They went into the rocks. I mean, their parachutes deployed and everything, but they went into the rocks at the base. It was the landing that screwed them up.
Oh, right, because they can't, like hang gliders, you know, you can steer those things and go someplace where you want to land, but parachutes have a tendency to go straight down at the back in 65.
Well, kind of. Not totally, because, you know, they had parachutes you could, even in those days, because I was jumping in 1960.
Okay.
You could steer, but they weren't as steerable
right.
as a hang glider. So I'm not sure exactly what kind of rig they had. But even so, you know, when you're only 5 feet away from the wall,
right.
when you fall, you only have X amount of room horizontally
right.
to get out to the meadow.
Right.
And in this case, they didn't.
Okay.
So they end up getting banged up. So that's in 1965. And it wasn't illegal, at least not the way it was interpreted initially, because nobody was doing it. I mean, we didn't even know it was on the radar screen.
Okay.
But there is a provision in the Code of Federal Regulations that does say something about delivery by parachuter, you know,
right.
or something like that. And, you know, I can't cite it off the top of my head exactly, but it events ends up being the misdemeanor law or regulation that we ended up citing parachutists. So, but over the years, of course, there's all, you know, illegally people would try to sneak in and they'd jump off late in the evening, you know, right before dark, or perhaps real early in the morning.
Hmm.
And it became sort of a cat and mouse game with the parachutists.
Okay.
Over the years. And it finally, for just a backtrack for just a second, I think that the park estimates that there are between 50 and 100 illegal jumps made every year.
Wow.
So in 1980, for I think it was 48 days, it turns out, if I'm not mistaken, the chief ranger, and you know, with the approval of the superintendent,
mm-hmm.
give the parachutists an opportunity to prove their point, which was, okay, 12 jumpers, you guys will self-regulate. There's a certain level in parachuting as well, just like there is in hang gliding, and
yep.
only the most experienced can do this.
Uh-huh.
And so this was done as an experiment to see and to satisfy the parachuting community. And I have a sign framed in my home. A cardboard sign that was put up, which is an original, which I probably ought to donate to the park, I guess.
Yeah.
That says that hang gliding is permitted between, this month and this month it was a 90-day period that was going to be permitted.
Okay.
Now, the thing I worry about a little bit talking to you, Tom, is what I just said, 90 days, you know, truth is, I'm not 100% sure it wasn't 60 days.
Okay, but there was some time period.
Yeah. I make these statements, and most of them are as accurate as I could make them, but that doesn't mean that they're foolproof.
Relax. It's an oral history interview, so we're not looking at pieces of paper here. It's,
okay.
You're good.
Well, but I like to be as factual and accurate as I can be.
Well, that's appreciated, but yeah, no, don't worry.
So anyway, they've got this 90-day window to prove themselves. Well, just as luck would have it, and over the 48 days now, and 48 becomes significant here in a second, but during this period of time, we start understanding that, one, there are more jumpers than 12.
Oh.
Two, we understand, you know, people using pogo sticks and bicycles to parachute off.
Why?
Well, just for the fun of it, just because they can do it. Right?
Huh.
So, I mean, it's not enough just to run off the cliff and throw yourself over and parachute. You know, once you've done that once or twice, it probably becomes more exciting to ride a bicycle off to.
Maybe you get further out. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's probably true, too. And actually, the very first I mean, there's a great photo that exists that I have a copy of anyway, of a guy by the name of Rick Sylvester skiing off the top of El Cap.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's a whole story attached to that, too. That was 1972, I think. So, so fast forward to 1980. That's where we've got this experiment. It's legal for a 90-day window. Well, it turns out they're abusing it so badly that they're just hanging on by a teeth when it comes to permission.
Okay.
And at this point, I'm now the district ranger out in Mather, which is the high country, everything north of Yosemite Valley, Tuolumne Meadows, Hetch Hetchy, et cetera, is all within this district that I'm the supervisor for now. And I'm just on a road patrol. It's late in the afternoon in the fall, I think. And I drive by a small little campground up on the Tioga Road, which is the main road across, the only road across the Sierra at that point.
Right.
So, and I see this stake bed truck with roughly 15 people in the back of it. And they're trying to sneak down. They've driven between some boulders, which outline this camp site, this campground. And the boulders have actually blocked off an old road that goes out towards the top of El Capitan.
Oh, wow.
And it's very fortuitous, I guess, that I actually run across them at this time as they're making this, driving, you know, into this area that's now been locked off to vehicles.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't take me very long with a, you know, a skydiving background that I had to recognize the fact that these were parachutists. And that what they were ending up doing was trying to film an episode for a TV series called That's Incredible. Which for at that time was a pretty fun real life kind of adventure thing. But so I ended up stopping the vehicle, and at this point nobody had parachuted, so I really couldn't do much with that, but I did cite the driver. But I also talked to these guys, and by the time I got done with them, they recognized that I, from a parachuting standpoint, knew what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned it around. I got hold of the chief ranger, and at that point, he terminated this entire 90-day experiment, which turns out to be, I think, only 48 days. So these guys, you know, screwed themselves because they weren't able to police and take responsibility for their actions like the hang gliders had been.
Yeah, interesting.
So, but it's still, you know, over the years, there have been parachutists, skydivers have been trying to, jump from, in Zion and Toro Weep. And I think I actually identified one time probably 15 different national park areas that have had, illegal parachuting. Black Canyon of the Gunnison.
Right. Right. Well, of course, now, too, there's paragliders. So we have these.
Yeah.
These parachutes that basically are wings, are airfoils that are steerable. Now you really do have the ability to kind of go where you want to go a little bit. You're still dropping, but you actually have a rate of glide with forward progress. How did that would have happened, I suppose, after you left. But I'm just curious if you know how the park handled that.
Well, I don't think the park handled it. I mean, it was just something that happened, and they did all these cat and mouse. The rangers became sort of a game. Some rangers took it more seriously than others.
Got it. Okay.
But I think over time there have been 5 people killed. Parachuting, and then one drowned trying to escape from the rangers.
Oh, my. Okay.
Several recordings back, I talked about taking my parachute to the top of Rainbow Bridge.
Yes, yeah.
Well, that's the reason I remember that the first incident off of El Cap, the first known parachuting, skydiving incident in a national park was on this date in 1965 by these two guys that ended up landing in the rocks.
Right.
But the reason I know that is because, you know, before them, I had taken my parachute to the top of Rainbow Bridge, and that even at 23, I recognized I was probably going to kill myself.
Mm.
But I also knew that in retrospect, long years later, that I would have been the Park Service's first base jumping fatality or paraplegic.
Yeah, as an employee, right? And,
well. I think the Park Service would have disowned me and said I was on my own time.
Right, right. Yeah. Did you ever jump in Yosemite?
No.
Okay.
No, but frankly, you know, when I was doing the parachuting,
mm-hmm.
This would have been attractive to me.
Yeah.
I was at a spot in my jump career because we were pushing the envelope every day when we were parachuting in the 60, 61, 62.
Okay.
That I would have found this attractive had I known about it, you know, had it been easy kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been something I would have certainly considered. I even considered parachuting, you know, in New River Gorge, they have jump day. One day a year, the main highway that crosses this bridge that's about 800 feet high, the park and the state of West Virginia, whichever.
Okay.
They actually close the road down, at least half of the road. I mean, half of it. They, you know, the highway patrols there.
One of the lanes. Okay. Uh-huh.
So that people end up parachuting off of this bridge.
Huh.
And it's really quite a profit-making thing for the local economy, and it's touted mm-hmm. every year. It's a big deal. Now it's legal, but it's the only time you can legally jump off this bridge. Well, I was a superintendent at Padre Island at the time, Corpus Christi, and I got hold of, because I was starting to work on one of my books, my first book, I guess, and I talked to the guy that was the head parachutist guy, the one that was doing all the illegal jumps, for one thing. And he said that if I would show up, you know, if I would come, he would outfit me and talk me through this. So I was sort of mentally gearing up to parachute off of this bridge just because I could do it.
Yeah.
Right, legally. Well, again, I think by this time I was old enough and smart enough to know that, you know, hey, I could get seriously hurt, and I had two kids I was raising and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I never did it. Sometimes I look back and say, you know, that would have been a nice thing to have tried, but I didn't. So, anyway.
Hmm. Okay. Well, no, this is really fascinating to put in the concept of river running and backpacking and horseback riding and some of the recreational activities that happen in national parks, climbing, big wall climbing, and hang gliding and parachuting, some of which are more dangerous than others, and some of which are more popular than others. You know, so thinking about backpacking in Yosemite, there's tens of thousands of people doing that every year.
Yeah.
So all year round. So this is really interesting. Just thinking about. Where the service says, all right, we're going to allow this in it. You're going to police yourselves. We're only going to allow this so many a day. And we want to protect the view shed. Protecting the resources is what the Park Service is all about.
Right.
That makes sense. But again, if the public can't handle it themselves, then the agency has no choice but to step in. And very fascinating pondering that.
The Land Management Agency is not just the Park Service, but, you know, BLM and Forest Service. You know, these agencies have got real headaches because they're trying to manage different missions, Park Service trying to manage resource as well as provide let people do stuff too.
Right.
And enjoy. And sometimes those don't jive. I mean, sometimes you can't allow both things.
That's right.
So,
But the resource comes first. I mean, unimpaired, the resource comes first. That's clear. But again, you know, the Park Service is trying to figure out how to manage this. That makes sense. I mean, it's a really interesting approach, which puts the responsibility on the people that are doing the activity and lets them handle it if they will.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you were talking, Tom, I actually looked up the little couple of pages I have in one of my books about parachuting. And in this book, which is dated now, of course, you know, like 1999 or something, but I have 12 areas that were listed as places where people have parachuted.
Okay.
Amistad, Arches, Black Canyon, the Gunnison, Canyon de Chelly, Glacier, Glen Canyon, Grand Canyon off of Navajo Bridge, Jefferson Expansion, New River Gorge, Statue of Liberty, 1912, before it became an MPS area, Yosemite and Zion. And I suspect there are, you know, a couple places since then that have, you know, experienced this as well.
Right. Gee, I wouldn't want to parachute off the Navajo Bridge because there's going to be some swimming involved, and you're going to have to figure out how to get home once you get down.
Well, you know, and sometimes, you know, these people that do these things think that far ahead, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Well, once again, we've had a wonderful hour and 10-minute discussion here, very fascinating. This sounds like maybe a good place to sort of wrap up the climbing and other sort of airborne adventures,
yeah.
In Yosemite. Is there anything else you want to bring into this?
to sort of cap off the parachuting thing for
please.
Just a moment. And to put myself back in the center of attention.
Good.
I don't necessarily like to do, but I do a lot of stupid things. So in this case, in the fall of 1980, roughly October of 1980, I am approached, because I'm now the district ranger out in Mather, which is the Tuolumne sub-district, it's actually the Mather district. And I am contacted by some cavers from the southeast part of the United States who, as a group, about 8 or 10 of these guys have taken off on a couple of week vacation, and they have been doing these deep rappelling drops into some of these deep caves in Mexico.
Okay.
As well as some that may be 500 or 700 feet deep in the United States as well. And they contact me because they are going around the country rappelling, and they get hold of me and ask if, because I still belong to the National Speleological Society, or the NSS, the National Caving Group.
Okay.
To this day, I still belong, although, you know, I'm not an active caver, but I support the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And they get hold of me in 1980 and want to know if I can help them orchestrate rappelling off of El Cap. So, okay. So they show up. I said, yeah, no, come on out. We'll work out something. They come out, and, you know, I've been there almost 10 years by this point. I'm pretty senior when it comes to the ranger operation. And things are a little more relaxed than in those days as well, but we weren't hurting anything. So we end up, I'm not going to take any credit initially. They end up lowering a rope. They have a parachute cord, long, several thousand feet of parachute cord that's tied to a tether ball that they lower down the face of El Cap. At the bottom, they tie on a rappel rope that's 4,000 feet long, and they pull it back up. So now they've got this long rope.
Wait. I'm just thinking about this going, I got 3,000 feet of rope. These are going to be really strong people to haul that rope up.
No, they have a windlass at the top.
Oh my gosh, what smart people.
They've been doing this now for a while. I mean, you know, some of these guys are, you know, engineers and smart people, but they love caving. This is their thing in life.
Yeah. Okay.
And, so they end up getting this, what will amount to is a 2,650-foot long rappel that they are going to do, which ends up becoming the world's record.
Wow.
So they asked me if I want to make the drop. I say, well, yeah. You know. And, I'm on my own time. I'm sure that I signed a lease slip.
So, Butch, hang on, wait. Let's back up a minute. How long does it take the average caver, very skilled caver, to rappel 2,650 feet?
Well, nobody knew at the time because nobody had ever done it that far.
Well, there's a problem with heat buildup in the climbing gear, in the rappel bar and stuff. How do you handle that?
Well, you're too smart for your britches, Tom, because you are right in most ways, except that this has already been taken into account.
Okay, well, these guys are smart. They have a windlass. I'm thinking about pulling it up by hand.
Yeah, no, they don't do that. Well, so let me describe. So what's going on is we are, there's roughly 10 or 12 that are going to rappel, and some of them are going to climb back up, going to two more back up, too.
Whoa.
I do not do that. Now, I've done a lot of things, you know, and I'm not afraid of heights particularly, but from my climbing standpoint, once I got more than 400 or 500 feet off the ground on a climb, I really started getting nervous, and I was never, even though I did some big wall stuff, I would never be considered any kind of a big wall climber. So, so making this rappel, over the years, they have developed a thing called a descending rack or a rappel rack, and what it amounts to is a U-shaped bar, a metal bar that's been tempered in, you know, as the proper alloys and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That is a perfectly strong. It's got a loop at the end so it can be hooked to a carabiner or more than one probably. And then on this U-shaped rack, which is bent, and the interior is about 2 inches, 2.5 inches wide.
Right, there are a bunch of breaker bars across
it. That's exactly right.
Okay,
brake bars.
Got it.
So for the general audience, you just weave the rope through these brake bars, which is actually pretty easy to do. And then as you're going down, the heat is dissipated among these brake bars.
Oh, that's amazing.
And you can adjust by clenching one or two of these bars together, you can slow your speed down and even stop.
Interesting. Okay.
So I've never even seen one of these things, but yet I'm about to drop 2,650 feet, all on the say-so of these guys that I'm trusting, because I'm not mostly very smart. So I end up making this rappel. It takes me 45 minutes.
Wow.
The fastest was something like about 15 minutes. And the problem with that is, and we were warned not to do that, you know, by the people that own the equipment and, and the ropes and whatever.
Right.
Because it will glaze the rope.
Right.
It will, there'll be enough heat
that
the nylon will melt a little bit.
Yeah.
It doesn't become super dangerous necessarily, but it's not good for the equipment.
Mm.
And at least one guy was ostracized. I mean, he was not allowed to participate with this group, at least here, any further because he went, you know, he was showing off and, you know, because he could go real fast. And at the very bottom, he ends up glazing this rope.
Wow. Gosh, I think you'd want to kind of smell the roses on that one once you got over the edge. You'd
well, be like... these guys had a heck of a lot more experience in long drops. I'd only made, by this point, I'd made a number of 600-foot drops, but nothing of that magnitude.
Mm.
So, but it ends up becoming a world's record, which is only lasts for about a year.
Wow.
But so I'm making this rappel, and there's no safety. So because of the way this rappel rack, this descending rack is designed, for most ropes, for most drops, most long rappels, anything over 500 feet or so, there's so much weight on the rope that you can't move. You can't go downwards. So anything over, say, 600 feet, you end up, for a rescue, now we're talking about rescues, or for rappelling, I suppose, you have to have one of these rappel racks. And the little mechanism is designed to accommodate this weight factor. So I was told about this, and so I'm rappelling over. And the first 50 feet as I'm going over the ledge, it is a little difficult. I have to sort of pull the rope through the system.
Right.
But not too far down, I'm able to start moving along, and I sort of quickly get used to how to adjust this thing to dictate my speed.
Okay.
And I had been warned about a couple things. One was that there's so much rope played out in this entire thing, 2,600 feet worth of 7/8-inch thick rope.
Huh.
No, not 7/8.
7/16. So that's just under half inch, or is it?
Under half an inch.
Okay.
There's so much rope played out that it actually acts like a sail.
Okay, wow.
So you actually can get lifted up, which is what happens. So I was told about this. I was told that as I'm rappelling, even with just a minor breeze, if there's enough breeze on the entire face,
yeah,
you've got this big sail. And so even though the rope is going through the system, and in theory you're going down, because of the sail effect, you actually could be going up.
Right.
So I was told just to be alert to that.
Is the bottom end of the rope like tied to a tree or something?
No, there's actually somebody monitoring it, though, at the bottom.
Okay.
And the theory was that you could, and now at this point, I don't have a radio.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not talking to anybody. I'm just, once I go over the edge,
You're on your own. There you go.
Other than yelling, I'm on my own. But in theory, and for me, somehow, when I first went over the first 50 or 100 feet or so, the guy at the bottom, when you hold on to that rope, you put enough resistance that you can't move. You are tied to that spot. You know, I mean, it's just the mechanics and the physics of all this.
Hmm.
You literally can't go up or down until that person at the bottom releases the hold. Well, somehow there was a miscommunication. The guys at the top watching me start off thought that I was in trouble or needed some help or something. So they told the guy at the bottom by radio to, hold on to this rope, which stops you from rappelling. Well, that was 180 degrees off what I wanted, all the opposite of what I wanted or needed. But that was finally resolved. It took a couple of minutes before everybody realized that I was doing fine. Just let go of the rope at the bottom and let me keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So the sail effect is one thing, but the thing that they didn't warn me about that actually got my attention more, perhaps, was I'm down maybe starting to go down 1,000 feet, and on these big cliffs, even though they look fairly flat, they're actually what they call a book or a corner. So there'll be a ledge, the cliff will be, going from left to right as you're facing it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're only 4 or 5 feet away from the wall because I was told, don't put your feet on the wall because that'll add to a spinning effect, which you don't want to do.
Oh, interesting.
So even though the wall was right there, it's like 4 or 5 feet away, mm-hmm. I was not touching it.
Okay.
But you build up a certain amount of comfort knowing that the wall's right there, even though if something happens, you're dead.
Right.
So as I'm going down, there is this, in addition to this sail effect, you end up getting into these long pendulums, very slow, but you've got a maybe a 50 to a 75 foot arc.
Wow.
That you're going from like left to right and right to left, but you're doing it pretty slowly. It's not like you're going back and forth real fast, but it is happening. So you're going down, the wall's 4 feet away, it's 4 feet away, you're not touching it, but there's some comfort knowing it's right there. And then as you're sort of pendulum left to right, let's say, which in this case is the one that caught my attention, is that all of a sudden, I'm 4 feet away, 4 feet away, and the next thing I know, I'm like 40 feet away from the wall because of this corner, this big crease in the rock that you really don't know is there, actually. But all of a sudden, what was somewhat comforting to me with this rope and wall being just a short distance apart, next thing I know, I'm 40 feet out, and I'm still 2,000 feet up. But all the while, I mean, I know that if anything happens, I'm totally a goner, you know. So, you know, when I made this drop, got down to the bottom 45 minutes later, and, you know, these other people are going, and I haven't told anybody in the park except one person because I needed to borrow his camera, which I ended up never using.
Oh.
I think I was either too scared or too preoccupied, or both probably.
Yeah.
To actually use it, because there's just a little pocket, you know, pocket camera thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to my wife later on that you know, when I get home, and she said that she'd gone into the valley because we didn't live in the valley anymore at this point. She'd gone into the valley to do something. We had two little kids at this point. And she comes back by and could sort of see where this was all taking place from the road. And I think if you look, you could probably see the rope, but it wasn't something that most people would notice, really. And as she's standing there outside the car trying to see what's going on, the guy who was mostly taking Jim Bridwell's place, I think my mind is slipping. At this point, he's probably the best climber in the world himself.
Okay.
That I've used on rescues. I've been on rescues with him personally, just he and I, and all kinds of fun stuff attached to that. And he also knows my wife. And he stops and says, you know, what's going on? Well, you know, Butch is up making this rappel off of El Cap. And here's a guy that is probably more comfortable on the face of El Cap than he is standing on the floor of the valley.
Right.
One of the world's best climbers, literally. This is literally true, not total hyperbole. And he tells her, I don't think it's tongue-in-cheek, maybe it was, Jesus, you would never get me to do that.
Wow.
And so, you know, I think this probably makes her a little nervous because, you know, the father of her children is up there probably about to kill himself, which, you know, fortunately I didn't do.
No kidding. Hey, Butch,
yes.
How did you keep from spinning?
I don't know that I don't think I kept from spinning. I just don't think I don't think it was going to spin.
Okay. I mean, it was that type of rope that didn't spin, I suppose.
No, it wasn't. That's correct. I mean, it's not a twist rope.
Right.
For one thing, it's got a sheath.
Right. It's a Perlon type or a Golan type.
Not Golan. But yeah, it's got a sheath to it, like a
sheath type. Yeah. Yeah, with fibers in the middle and a sheath coating on the outside.
Yeah, and it's also a static rope, which means that there's no stretch.
Right, okay.
If I said early on that this is a stretch rope.
No, you didn't.
No, but our rescue rope back in 1972 was.
Right.
But in this case, this is a caving rope. It's designed for making rappels. It's not designed for rescue work.
Right.
So.
Oh, fascinating.
Anyway, so wow. We were going to stop at that point, I guess, a long time ago.
Well, so did anybody get a picture of you up there?
I had a picture of me at the bottom.
Oh, that's great. Oh, fun.
And although, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, I suspect that if I still have, you know, since I belong to the NSS still, the National Speleological Group, and I have the names of these guys, I could probably go on there and find one or two of them and see if perhaps they've got some photos from that, not necessarily of me, but from that whole thing.
That would be fun.
Huh. But I've never done it. I guess I should have. You know, it's not like I don't have enough projects. But
I'll give you more things to do.
Yeah.
This has been wonderful. And I think then with that, this will conclude part 9 of a oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee. My name is Tom Martin. Today's Thursday, June 18th, 2020. And Butch, thank you so very much.
Well, my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.